Chapter 7 Vince. In which Vince resolves the complexities of quotidian living in communal quarters into a mathematical formula, 3 against 1. I never really thought that I was an alcoholic until I completed rehab successfully. Then I became an alcoholic. Before, I just drank to have a good time. But after the accident, I kept trying to forget about what had happened. If I was to function in the world as a normal human being, I just couldn't keep putting myself through the guilt of Razzle and Lisa Hogan and Daniel Smithers. In therapy, however, they wouldn't let me forget anything. They forced me to work through my feelings about the accident every day until I wanted to start drinking so that I could forget about them all over again. It was a vicious circle. Even though I stayed sober, I knew that it was only a matter of one beer, one glass of wine, one bottle of Jack, until I was a full-on alcoholic, worse than I'd ever been. While I waited for the trial, I flew around the country and warned kids against drinking and driving, and that helped ward off the demons of alcoholism that were fluttering in my brain. But to be sober, you also need to have people around you who support you. And except for our managers, who offered me a diamond-bezeled gold Rolex if I could last 3 months without taking a drink, nobody was. On the plane, the guys would turn to me and ask as they chugged Jack and Coke, "Vince, could you pass that plate of Coke over there?" They'd smoke pot and blow it in my face. They acted like that the whole tour, and then if I ever broke down and took a drink, they'd chew me out and tell me I was hurting the band. While I was in rehab, Tommy had been driving his motorcycle fucked up with Joey Vera of Armored Saint on the back. He wiped out on the freeway and flipped the thing 6 times, crushing Joey's hand so he couldn't play bass. And no one said a word to Tommy. He kept drinking like it was nobody's business, getting so fucked up that our tour manager, Rich Fisher, would drag him out of bed when it was time to leave each hotel, throw him in the luggage rack, roll him downstairs to the bus, and then find a wheelchair in the airport to cart him onto the plane. One night, Rich handcuffed Tommy to the bed to keep him from drinking. But within an hour, Tommy had escaped and was downstairs, lying unconscious in a pile of broken glass from a restaurant booth divider he had just shattered. That was funny to the guys, but everything I did was wrong. One rule on the plane was hands off the stewardesses. But I was so bored staying sober that I'd always end up with the stewardess in the bathroom or the back closet or the hotel room after we landed. Then the band would find out and she'd get fired. To put me in my place, they hired the pilot's wife as a stewardess. Eventually, they even put a second security guard named Ira on the payroll, and his only job was to knock me out and take me up to my room if I drank or caused any trouble in public. In the meantime, everybody was having the time of their lives. While we were rehearsing for a new leg of the tour, Tommy showed up with some Polaroids he had taken while he fucked Heather Locklear. The two of them had suddenly started dating, and now we had the privilege of seeing Heather Locklear's ass up close. Women had become my new vice, too. But not women like Heather Locklear. Instead of drinking and drugs, I'd fuck a lot of groupies. And there were tons of them. I'd go through 4 or 5 girls a night. I'd have sex before a show, after a show, and sometimes during a show. It never stopped, because I never passed up an opportunity, and the opportunities were always there. A few times, when I really needed a distraction, I'd line up 6 naked girls on my hotel room floor or facing the wall, then run a sexual obstacle course. But the novelty wore off quickly. Even though I was married to Beth and we had a daughter, our relationship had hardly improved. Besides, her orange 240Z, which I loved so much, had blown up. So it was only a matter of time before our relationship did too. It seemed like all my relationships were exploding in my face. I could understand why the band was so upset, but what I did was over and done. As my bandmates, they should have been supporting me. After all, we had just recorded a weak album, and the first hit from it, a cover of Brownsville Station Smokin' in the Boys' Room, which I used to play with my old band, Rock Candy, was my idea. But every night, though I loved singing it live, Nicky would complain that the song was stupid and he didn't want to play it. Outside of Home Sweet Home, which MTV aired so much they had to establish an expiration date for new videos in order to stop the flood of requests, the rest of the album was pure shit. Every night, when I ran around on stage in my pink leather pants that laced up the sides, I felt like the only one sober enough to realize how bad some of those songs were. I was shocked the record went double platinum. And maybe it just reinforced the idea that we were so great we could even get away with putting out a terrible album. When we flew back to L.A. between legs of the tour, my lawyer arranged for a meeting in court with the district attorney and the families of the others involved in the accident. In order to avoid a trial, he advised me to plead guilty to vehicular manslaughter and strike a compromise. He figured that since the people drinking at my house were mostly in Motley Crue and Hanoi Rocks, the party could be explained as a business meeting, and we would be able to pay damages to the families through the band's liability insurance, because there's no way I could afford them on my own. This was why the families of the victims agreed to what everyone saw as such a light sentence. 30 days in jail, $2.6 million in restitution to them, and 200 hours of community service, which I'd already been chipping away at by lecturing in schools and on the radio. In addition, my lawyer told the DA that I could do more good lecturing on the road than I could sitting on my ass in prison, where I wouldn't be a benefit to anybody. The DA agreed and deferred my sentence until after the tour. The sentence was a huge relief, lifting a dark cloud that had been hanging over my head. But it was a mixed blessing, because now people hated me even more than they did before. The headlines in the paper calling me a murderer resurfaced, but now they were even meaner. Drunk killer Vince Neil sentenced to touring world with rock band.